Support for programming on NET Radio comes from Grand Island Tourism, who invite nature lovers to get stuck in Grand Island traffic. Hundreds of thousands of sandhill cranes create an aerial traffic jam every spring in Grand Island. To learn more, see thecranes.com. And Contemplate Lincoln, a nonprofit Christian contemplative center whose mission is to be transformational, authentic, faithful, and life-giving. Located at 31st and P Street in Lincoln, and on the web at contemplatelincoln.org.
Good morning and welcome to Friday Live here on NET Radio, live from the Mill in Lincoln's Haymarket. I'm Robert Goldberg in for Genevieve Randall. Ahead on this morning's show, we'll hear from a duo who define their style as 60s prom rock. I'll also talk with Emily Rain Blythe and Eugene H. Russell IV about their roles in Dutchman at the Nebraska Repertory Theater. And we'll hear from the young piano virtuoso Charlie Albright, who's coming through Kearney next week. There's also a whole lot more, too. If you'll be away from your radio later, you can listen using the NET Nebraska mobile app or stream the show online at netnebraska.org. Just click on the button that says Live and On Demand. The Glencorf School of Music is presenting a student-led performance of Aaron Copland's opera The Tender Land in three towns across Nebraska beginning next week. The Tender Land takes place in a Depression-era rural community and depicts the life of a young girl, her family, and two migrant workers in a coming-of-age tale that reflects the hardworking spirit of the Midwest. Here to talk to me about the production is Bill Shomos, opera director at the Glencorf School of Music at UNL, and Pam Mrodka from Friend, Nebraska, one of the tour stops. Good morning, Bill and Pam.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you.
Bill, let me start with you. This is not an opera that gets staged particularly often. Tell us about the piece and how and why you chose it.
Well, it's really perfect for taking out into rural communities. It talks about who we are in the Midwest and in very beautiful ways. There was a production of this back in 1993 where they took the Tender Land out in Minnesota to farms, and I remember it, they did a special on it on Charles Kuralt's the Sunday morning show, and I remember being moved by it about how the people responded to this piece because it was so meaningful for them.
Well, how many students are involved in the production, both on stage and behind the scenes?
Well, we've got 16 people on stage and quite a few backstage as well.
It takes a lot to put on an opera.
It does.
Pam, how did you get involved in this tour, and tell us about your work with the Warren Opera House in bringing this production to Friend?
The way we got involved in it, someone had notified me that there was an opportunity through the Sechrist family to bring opera to rural Nebraska, and I called the number and I reached Bill and I said, "You must come to Friend. You've got to see our venue. We think you must put a production on in our second story opera house."
Tell us a bit about that space.
Our opera house is over 100 years old, and it's one of the few second-story opera houses in the state, and we want to bring it back to its grandeur that it was in those days. And so about 3 years ago, Bill brought The Wedding of Figaro, and now we're coming again, and this will be the second opera to be performed in our...
Well, wonderful. You're bringing it back to life.
Yes, yes.
Bill, over the course of about 4 days, you'll be in Friend, Ord, and Wayne. Mm-hmm. I know you've taken your UNL productions on the road before. Mm-hmm. Why is it important to you to do these runouts into other communities beyond the UNL campus?
Well, I think the university belongs to the entire state, and I think what we do here, we should take what we do here and share it with everyone who is a partner with us. If I could say something about the space in Friend, the Warren Opera House, you go in there and it's a really remarkable thing they've got there. You walk in and you see this history, you see this place where people were trying to create something really remarkable. Mm-hmm. And to go up to the second floor and see this opera house modeled on this. I think it's a European model that people were striving to really make themselves elite when that word elite actually had a really positive connotation.
Well, it's fascinating that in so many small towns across the state there are these opera houses.
Yes,
you know, who would have thought? It's a time past, but it's wonderful that they're being revived here, Pam. And
significantly, we were actually the first group to actually present a real opera there when we did Marriage of Figaro there, and so this is only the second time that an opera is going to be presented in the Opera House, and we're sure looking forward to it.
Great. Well, Pam, it's a logistical undertaking, I'm sure, to host a cast and a crew of a full opera and all the sets, costumes that go with it. What have you done on your end to make that all happen?
Well, we have coordinated with our local school, and students from grades 7 to 12 will be walking to our opera house for the performance, and the school students will be helping us set up and tear down and anything else that we need. And Bill will be doing a pre-talk the day before to prepare the students so that they will know what they're doing.
It takes a village. Wonderful.
Yes, yes.
Well, the last question. I know that you and your students are busy all year long. What projects are up ahead after the Tenderland?
This is the end of our opera season. We do classes. We have an opera showcase that we do at the end of the year. There's a musical theater showcase that we have. But also, I don't think we mentioned this, the Tenderland, we're doing it this weekend at Kimball Hall with orchestra Friday and Sunday, tonight and Sunday.
Wonderful. So the Lincolnites can grab it as well.
They can. It's for everyone.
The UNL Opera Department's production of Aaron Copland's Tenderland is in Friend at 9 a.m. on February 27th at the Warren Opera House, in Wayne at 7:30 p.m. February 28th at Our Savior Lutheran Church, and in Ord at 7:30 p.m. March 2nd at the Golden Husk Theater. And Bill, as you just mentioned, also this
7:30 tonight and 3 o'clock on Sunday in Kimball Hall.
Terrific. Well, Pam and Bill, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today. Best of luck with the performances.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
There's much more ahead here on Friday Live. In the next 15 minutes, I'll be talking to the director of the dance troupe Catapult, who'll be in Scottsbluff next week. Serving your community anywhere that might be, NET Radio is Nebraska's public radio network. I'm Robert Goldberg. Joining me now are actors Emily Blythe and Eugene H. Russell IV from the Nebraska Repertory Theaters, whose whole 2018-19 season is called Hashtag History Makers. You're both in a current run of Dutchman, which tells a story about an emotionally powerful encounter that occurs between a white woman and a black man on a train in the 1920s. How does the play fit within the History Makers umbrella? What'd you guys say? I know you're just in this one production, but it sends a message, I think, that's probably part of the whole season of the theater.
Yeah, well, the beauty of history is, the specific beauty of history is when you can connect it to present day and learn from it and draw from it. So this piece was actually first produced in 1964, just before the assassinations of Dr. King and Malcolm X. And the issues that it deals with are unfortunately still very much relevant today. So I think that's where it fits in, history as a tool to drive us forward.
Sure, well, history is present, right? Everything that's we do now is going to be somebody's history.
Future history, that's right.
Well, the whole play occurs within a train car. Dramatically and from a production standpoint, does the limited set play a role in telling the story?
Definitely. I think it really adds to the audience's experience. If anything, it kind of makes the way the setup of the stage and everything, where the audience is placed, it makes them feel like they're part of the ride with us. They're right there. And in such an enclosed space makes it a lot more intimate, a lot more tension involved.
Yeah, definitely more tense, too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little intense play. The issue of racism is a strong theme throughout the play. And although we've come a long way from the American etiquette of the 1920s, the story is still so relevant, especially in light of the racially charged times that we're living in. Can either of you talk a bit more about that?
Absolutely. Without giving too much of the play away, because you guys will be coming to see it before we close, right? Great. the racism aspect of it, or how it tackles the issue of racism, very specifically, it deals with Black America's decades-long struggle, centuries-long struggle even, of fighting to determine ourselves for ourselves, fighting to define ourselves in the face of many narratives, many media-driven narratives, many false narratives that attempt to define us, instead of seeing us for who we are and allowing us to determine, again, for ourselves who we are, trying to force us to fit into certain boxes filled with preconceived notions. And it's a battle that, unfortunately, we continue to fight.
Yeah. Well, Emily, in the play, you act as a vibrant nonconformist white woman who has tendencies to talk in a racially hostile way.
Uh-huh.
Eugene, you're her foil. What has it been like working together, and what have you learned from each other?
Oh, wow. I was really nervous to start the whole process because I looked up Eugene and I figured out how accomplished he was and talented, and I didn't know what I was going to do, but he's been quite fun to work with. I think we work really well together. We communicate well, and it's made the process a lot easier because of just how racially charged and intense the show is. We deal with a lot of themes that are hard to work with. But
And Emily's fearless. I mean, she's helped me get to where I need to get for the end of the show. Again, I won't give it away, but she's just fearless. You know, I don't even see her as a student. She's a pro. She's bringing it as much as any other pro I've ever worked with, and we push each other, and I love that.
Wonderful. What a team. Yeah. Well, following the show, there's a talkback segment where the audience is able to converse with you. Do you see that as an important part of the whole experience of this production?
100%. I think one of the main focuses, and what the director, Ron Himes, what we talked about even from the beginning of the process, is that not only is the show meant to spark people's thoughts and everything, but it's meant to spark a discussion because, especially why we set it and why we're doing it in Nebraska, it's to get people to talk about something that's maybe uncomfortable or taboo, just like the show, to get people discussing. And if you can't talk about the themes of the show, maybe you can just talk about the show itself.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with actors Emily Blythe and Eugene Russell from the Nebraska Repertory Theater's latest production of The Dutchman. You can see the last few performances of the show tonight through Sunday at 7:30 with a matinee on Saturday at 2. Thank you both for taking time this busy week to sit down and talk with me today.
Thank you for having us.
For more information on these concerts or anything else you hear about on Friday Live, go to netnebraska.org/radio and find the Friday Live page. I'm Robert Goldberg. Be sure to check out the arts calendar on our website, both to make plans and to add your event. The address is netnebraska.org/radio. Just click events. Here are some highlights. In Hickman this weekend, the Stage Theater presents A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. A distant heir to a family fortune sets out to speed up the line of succession by using a great deal of charm and a bit of murder. Continuing at the Bemis Center is I Let Them In, Conditional Hospitality and the Stranger, a two-person exhibition featuring videos by Kader Atiyah and Candice Brights and curated by Terena Fitzili. Amidst the current migration crisis, these artworks explore who is afforded the right to speak or the ability to be understood. Also continuing is Optical Chronicle 3 at the Museum of Nebraska History in Kearney. The exhibition is the third in a series of four exhibitions, each dedicated to one of author Henry M. Sayre's four guiding principles. For more information about these and other events, visit our website, netnebraska.org/radio.
Support for humanities-related programming on NET Radio comes from Humanities Nebraska, delivering opportunities to engage with history and culture on the web at humanitiesnebraska.org. And support for programming comes from History Nebraska, Nebraska archaeologists work side by side with private landowners to protect Nebraska's archaeological heritage. To learn more, history.nebraska.gov.
The difference between good art and great art is its ability to tell a story. My next guests use their extraordinary dance talent to do just that. Silhouetted behind a screen, they weave and combine their bodies into expressive shapes and characters. They're called Catapult, and they're bringing their show to the Midwest Theater in Scottsbluff next Thursday evening. I'm talking to Adam Battlestein, the director of Catapult. Adam, thank you so much for joining me on the phone today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Catapult is such a unique troupe. Their work is unlike anything most people have seen and very different to what people think of when they hear the word dance. For those who aren't familiar with Catapult, can you start by describing to us what it is they do?
We are great art because we tell stories. I wish that were the only criteria. We are telling stories using human bodies that come together to form shapes behind the screen, shapes that are visible as shadows. So one moment you'll see dancers, and in the next moment you may see an elephant, for instance, or an automobile, or something surprising and unexpected. And while you're watching it happen, it's a little like a magic trick. You can see it happening, but you just can't figure out how it's happening.
I've seen some of them, and it is hard to imagine how they make those shapes. Is it all body shapes, or are there props?
There are some props. But as much as possible, we try to use our bodies. So when we just can't find another way, we will add a prop. Like, we can make a pretty damn good pig, but it needs the tail. So the little curly key tail would be a prop. We make a darn good car, but the steering wheel is, you know, a prop. So we do what we need to do to finish off the image.
Right.
Some images are completely made out of bodies, and so we only use the props where it's necessary.
How did Catapult come together as a company, and how did the idea take hold? I'm also curious to know where the name Catapult comes from.
Catapult came out of a time in my life in 2008, 2009, when things just weren't very good in this country. It was a tough time to be out of work. My situation had just taken a turn for the worse. I had quit my job. I just was in a situation where I needed a new way forward for the next chapter of my life. I was ending a very long chapter of spending almost 20 years with one dance company and doing a lot of wonderful things with them, but moving on to a new chapter. And Catapult came out of that tough time. I really felt like I needed to catapult myself out of my situation, and that name appealed to me because it had dynamism and energy, and I wanted a seat on the catapult.
How's the dance world responded to what you do?
I'm not aware of resistance in the dance world because I guess I'm kind of out of touch with the dance world here in, you know, this beautiful countryside where I live in Kent, a tiny little town of 2,000 people. I'm not aware of how they think about us. And maybe they just don't.
The show at the Midwest Theater is a collection of stories. Can you tell us about some of them and if there's a thread that links them?
There are seven separate stories in the show, and they really vary widely. The first piece on the program is the complete Four Seasons by Vivaldi. So we do spring and summer and fall and winter. And that's just, it was a joy to make it, and it's still fun to watch it, and audiences love it because it's just really kind of an explosion of imagery of the seasons and short vignettes that are funny and moving, and they kind of run the gamut. And then we get into a little more narrative with the next dance, which is about a young girl growing up called Milestones, and we speed through her life from the moment when she's building a sandcastle to graduating, to getting married and having a child, and passing on, you know, her parents passing on. So that's a little more narrative. And then we have a piece about the Berlin Wall coming down. We have a send-up of the Old West, which is was a lot of fun to make. I'm from Texas originally, so I had a lot of fun just thinking about imagery from the Old West and playing with stereotypes and iconic images from that time. And I really, really wanted to do a paddle crossing across a river. Friends of mine said, you're not going to be able to do that. But that's in there. We have a cattle crossing.
You pulled it off?
We pulled it off, and it's great. It's a great cattle crossing.
You're all most famous for your successful run through America's Got Talent. What was that experience like for you, and did it affect who Catapult was versus what they perhaps became after that experience?
It changed everything. It was an incredible experience. It was crazy. It was its own reality. I'm sure everybody's aware at some level that reality shows are their own reality. It was super challenging. It was, in some ways, very supportive of an artistic vision. And it changed the company a lot, because before America's Got Talent, we were a corporate entertainment company only. So we did 3 to 5, maybe 10 minutes of material at big corporate events for big companies like IBM and Bridgestone Tires and many other big companies. But we didn't have a concert, and we didn't really create work for the public.
Your stop in Scotts Bluff is part of a national tour through the Midwest and beyond. Catapult will be performing next Thursday evening, February 28th, at the Midwest Theatre in Scotts Bluff at 7:30. Adam Battlestein, thanks so much for taking time to talk with me about your show.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
For more information on this event and others across Nebraska, go to netnebraska.org/radio and find the Friday Live page. I'm Robert Goldberg. Saturday marks the 2019 Lunar New Year celebration. The Asian Community and Cultural Center is hosting their annual celebration in honor of the holiday this Saturday at 1 to 4 p.m. at the Lancaster Event Center's Lincoln Room. I'm happy to have Rebecca Reinhardt from the Cultural Center here to talk about it this morning, as well as Claire Kuhn and Skylar Cruz from UNL. Welcome to you all. Each year is associated with a Chinese zodiac animal that recurs every 12 years. What is this year's animal, and what does it represent?
Hi, very happy for being here. This is the year of the pig. So the pig, like you see the shape, you know, kind of like a rich and a lucky for the people.
Yes.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So it's a lucky year? It's a good year?
It is a lucky year. A lot of the animals kind of like against each other, but the pig is very gentle and good with all the animals. So this year will be the lucky, happy, and the peace year.
I like it. Well, it bodes well for a wonderful year ahead. I'm glad to hear it.
Yes.
The Lunar New Year is typically celebrated all across Asia and across the world.
Right.
How do traditions differ across the globe, and what traditions is the Asian Cultural Center incorporating into this year's event?
Okay. The people celebrate the Lunar New Year just like the people in America celebrate the Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big holiday for all the Asian people. We are so lucky to have so many local partnership organizations and a lot of performance groups and of course all the local community people to support us. So that's how we can have this event. This year we're going to have a lot of new performances for the audience. Yeah.
What if I was about to ask that? Actually, Claire and Skylar, tell us more about the event. What can visitors look forward to? I know that in years past there have been several performances from all sorts of different groups. So what performances are this year?
This year we have 11 different performance groups. 5 of them are new to our event this year.
Mm-hmm.
Our performances range from martial arts to lion dancing to the hip-hop dance club from UNL. So it'll bring just a bunch of different cultures together to help us celebrate
That sounds a lot of fun. And these performances are spread out across the afternoon?
Right. The performance actually, before, we always try to collecting the local different Asian cultural performance groups. But this year, we start to recruit a lot of local different cultural mm-hmm. group, not only right. Asian. So this time, we have like hip-hop and the ballroom dance and the belly dance.
Oh, but, oh.
And the first time, we have the Nepalist dance. So this is really new for our audience.
Well, I like the intercultural.
Right.
That's terrific.
Right. The whole world, right?
Exactly. Yes. The whole world. Rebecca, the Asian Community and Cultural Center does a lot of work in Lincoln. Tell us about the mission of the organization and some of your programs.
Okay, so the Asian Community Cultural Center, our mission is to serve the refugees and the immigrants and also share the cultural heritage with the community. That's our mission.
Right, and there are a lot of communities by Asian. It's
right. In our community, we serve the people from Korean, mm-hmm. Vietnam, China, and South Sudan, mm-hmm. and the people from Middle East.
Well, in addition to the Lunar New Year celebration, you also have a Harvest Moon event in the summer and your famous Curry Clash in the fall.
Right.
Can you tell us more about those events and others that the Asian Cultural Center is involved in?
So to share the cultural heritage, we kind of like present the cultural year-round. For the beginning of the year, always Lunar New Year celebration, and in the fall, we always have the Harvest Moon Festival. Mm-hmm. For the lot of Asian countries, they want to get the family together to celebrate the harvest. So, and also we have a lot of cultural activities like curry clash and fresh fry and some camp cultural. So to give the people who love the different culture mm-hmm. to learn difference.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is there anything else anyone wants to say about the project?
Yeah, we're so lucky to have two interns, one from UNL, one from Wesleyan University, and Claire, want to say something?
It's been an absolutely wonderful experience getting to learn more about our refugees here in the Lincoln community. Through our Lunar New Year experience, we're going to have nine different types of food from five different cultures. It'll be traditional Asian food from different restaurants here throughout the community. So it's been a really wonderful experience. It'll be a really wonderful event.
Wonderful. Well, I've attended the Curry Clash, and yeah. when it comes to food, you guys know how
right.
to do it, so that should be delicious.
So one thing I wanted to announce is that the weather for tomorrow will be bad, but to change an event is hard for us, so we're going to keep the event going.
Good.
And I just hope that the people come to our event, be safe, and you guys will have fun. You guys will see a lot of different cultural performances and try different food and a lot of special cultural activities. And we're going to teach the audience to make the dumplings, because the dumpling in a lot of Asian country is kind of like a very traditional dish on the table.
Wonderful. Well, if anyone's chilly tomorrow, they can warm themselves up with a dumpling.
Yes.
I'm sure it's worth going, even if it's snowing.
Yes.
Enjoy Asian cuisine, traditional games, art, and live performances with the Asian Community and Cultural Center to celebrate the 2019 Lunar New Year. The event is Saturday at the Lancaster Event Center. Thank you for coming in to talk this morning, Rebecca, Claire, and Skylar.
Thank you so much.
Did noisy traffic or a loud passenger in your car just interrupt your Friday Live experience? The digital world has given us a do-over. We podcast the show each week. You can look for that later this afternoon on our Facebook page or on our website. The address is netnebraska.org.
By the time I get this wrong, I got the feeling you'll be long gone. Love fits and starts and comes undone, till I'm left with only one, and it's been you all along. Well, if I don't say it, well, then I'll go crazy. I'm paralyzed by the thought of you just passing by.
you're looking for something to do in Southwest Nebraska next week, Freddie and Francine will be performing at the B-Rock Cafe, right next door to Senate's Bakery in McCook, on Thursday, February 28th. Joining me via the phone to talk about this concert are Lee Ferris and Bianca Caruso. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Listeners may wonder why I'm talking to Lee and Bianca instead of Freddie and Francine. But Lee and Bianca are Freddie and Francine. So how did you get those names?
That's a great question. About 10 years ago, we started writing songs together, and we wrote our first tune ever, which we titled Over and Over. And we, you know, jokingly described the genre of the song we wrote together as 1950s prom rock. You can laugh at that. When we performed it for the first time at a restaurant in Los Angeles where the band started, we said, okay, everyone, this is our 1950s prom rock ballad. You know, hit the dance floor, grab a partner, and come up with a really cheesy 1950s name. And he just said, I'll be Freddie. And I said, I'll be Francine. And by the end of the song, everyone was chanting Freddie and Francine, and there it began.
So it's 1960s prom rock. So that's a good label, but what is the sound?
In the beginning, there was sort of a retro throwback sort of influence to everything we were doing. And there were a lot of duos at the time that were in Los Angeles and New York that were coming out with a sound that sort of harkened back to the 50s and 60s. But I don't know. I mean, characterized by sort of poppy hooks dressed in sort of a melodramatic sort of delivery, and we hadn't quite found our sound yet. So, you know, it certainly has evolved since then. That was over 10 years ago now.
What is it more these days, would you say?
We use the terms Americana soul to kind of cover all the sounds. We're pulling from a lot of different stuff, and Freddie and Francine, you know, can be kind of an ode to like Johnny and June or like a Motown era. You know, sound, and it's, you know, we're pulling from country and R&B and folk music and the whole thing, and we find that Americana soul kind of covers all the bases.
You're good at naming your genres. I like them. They're very descriptive.
We try. We just want to make people feel safe in terms of, they always ask us, like, what is your sound? And we want to invite them in.
Speaking of feeling safe, what can our audience members expect to hear in McCook next week?
A whole bunch of new songs that we've been working on, as well as songs off the new album that we put out last September called Moonless Night, that have a lot of kind of, yeah, like Motown 60s-influenced soul tunes that are delivered with, you know, we pride ourselves in our singing. We're both classically trained, and we sing very strongly with a lot of harmonies, and we are very dynamic in our performance, and we do everything we can to make the whole evening entertaining, both during the songs and in between.
That sounds like a good night of entertainment.
I would hope so. That's what we aim to please.
Lee, you were Carl Perkins in the Broadway and touring productions of Million Dollar Quartet. What did you learn about yourself, and what did how did that turn you into perhaps the singer you are today?
Yeah, I was very grateful and very lucky to be a part of that production. I think one of the things that I learned the most about myself is that I found in myself professionalism, maybe for the first time. You know, in a lot of ways, when you're working as an independent musician, you really have to be self-starting, but you also, there isn't the consistency that live theater sort of demands. And I learned that the show always goes on, regardless of the, you know, of how tired you are, etc., but also that I have the ability personally to put on a good show and to be a professional in all situations. And I think it just gave me a lot of confidence to carry that over into the music that I write and perform nightly with Bianca. And it's an amazing foundation of confidence in that sense.
Well, where are you both from, and where do you live now, and how did you meet?
I'm from the woods of Maine by way of Austin, Texas. And then Lee is born and raised in Los Angeles, California. And we actually met in LA over 10 years ago at this point. We were doing a musical called Hair. You might have heard of it. And we were in that together. And that's kind of where, from there, the project was born. Freddie and Francine, the project was born out of that musical. And we about 11 months ago moved to Nashville, Tennessee. So that's where we reside now.
A lot of people just assume that a male-female duo is a couple. What, if I may ask, is your status?
We are, in fact, a married couple. We don't like to, you know, talk about it too much because we want it to be a mystery, and we want the audience to wonder. But we're going to tell you, and we hope that you won't tell anyone. Oh, wait, we're on the radio.
Well, Freddie and Francine, you'll be performing your music for a Nebraska crowd next Thursday in McCook at the B-Rock Cafe at 7:30 p.m. with the Capella Brass opening the show. And next Friday, Freddie and Francine journey on over to Hastings to play the Lark, also at 7:30 p.m. Lee Ferris and Bianca Caruso, Freddie and Francine, thank you for telling me about you and your music.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much. Look forward to the shows.
For more information on these concerts or anything else you hear about on Friday Live, go to netnebraska.org/radio and find the Friday Live page. I'm Robert Goldberg.
It's hard to tell the truth when it's staring back at you. There's no point, I guess, in lying to myself. Sometimes it feels so good. Ain't no way to go, baby, borrowed time and waste.
Tara Westover grew up in rural Idaho to a survivalist family. She had little access to modern medicine or even formal education.
Nor is Westover homeschooled, really. When her parents took her older brothers out of school, some homeschooling was done. By the time she reaches school age, she has learned to read, but there is little semblance of actual instruction happening. If she wishes to learn something, she may, but the only organized instruction tends to be religious.
On this week's All About Books, Pat Leach reviews Educated, a memoir, the remarkable story of Tara Westover, who overcame much to get into college, eventually earning degrees from Harvard and Cambridge. Hear the review online at netnebraska.org/allaboutbooks. I'm joined next by Jason Horner and the director of Lincoln Choral Artist, and Eli Mardock, the owner of the Royal Grove in Lincoln, where the Lincoln Choral Artists will be having their annual fundraiser on March the 3rd. Hi, guys. Welcome to you both.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
Jason, tell us about the Lincoln Choral Artists.
Well, we are in our 39th season, and we are so excited to be again at the Royal Grove for our big fundraiser event. We have about 40 singers on this concert this year, and we're putting together a small band to do a lot of stuff from musical theater in the last 25 years.
Sounds like a lot of fun. You put on a few shows a year, plus your annual fundraiser, which, as you said, has been at the Royal Grove here in Lincoln. There are a lot of great things at the fundraiser, and I know that there's a theme this year. So tell our listeners what they can look forward to when they attend the event.
So our overall theme for the year is Modus Emotus. We're exploring human emotions, and for this one, we're calling it The Big Show because you get in trouble for other things. But The Big Show, Joy and Inspiration. And so what are the songs from the musical theater world in the last quarter century that really focus on excitement and joy and being inspired?
Hmm. Eli, the Royal Grove is a legendary venue in Lincoln. You've been around in some form since about 1933. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the space and your partnership with Lincoln Choral Artists.
Well, as far as the space, it's incredibly unique, and it's such an authentic space. I mean, there's a lot of history there, so it's really we've been really happy with it, and I think with Lincoln Choral Artists, this is exactly the sort of event that we love to do. We do a wide variety of programming, from rock and metal to hip hop and just all sorts of things. We really love to do a community event like this and to feature, you know, a great local organization like Lincoln Choral Artists. Right. So it's really, really a special event for us.
Yeah, both of you. Well, Jason, when you aren't performing at hip hop multi-level clubs with dance floors, three bars, and an outdoor patio, where can we usually find the Lincoln Choral Artists doing their thing? And do those concerts look a bit different from what's coming up on March the 3rd?
They do. I mean, of course, in a lot of ways, we do a lot of traditional kind of choral setups where we're in churches or spaces at colleges and have kind of the risers and maybe an orchestra in front of us, which are wonderful concerts. What's great about this one is a chance to break up and do what I've talked with my singers about is some character building. So they're not in rows and they're not singing into the director, but they're singing out to the audience right. And making connections.
Right. Well, Eli, the same question for you. The Lincoln Choral Artists are a different kind of act from what one might hear on any given night at the Royal Grove. You mentioned the other types of genres of music. Tell us what shows are coming up and what's your typical fare?
We've got some really fun ones coming up. So one of the ones that, Thursday we have Symbionic, which is an electronic music act. He's from Austin, Texas. One of the ones I'm looking forward to the most is March 8th, which is Los Lonely Boys. It's a Grammy-winning kind of blues rock trio. And so we do, a wide variety of stuff and definitely some fun stuff coming up for 2019.
Great.
So,
Jason, have you given any thought to next year's season? Do you want to tip your hat to what concerts are in the works or perhaps even what next year's fundraiser might look like?
Well, we are definitely hard at work because it is our 40th season next year. And we are putting together some concerts with the Civic Orchestra, the Lincoln Boys Choir, and also we're going to continue our theme of a big show and probably be doing music from movies for our gala next year.
Sounds fun. I've been chatting with Jason Horner, director of Lincoln Choral Artists, and Eli Mardock, owner and operator of the Royal Grove in Lincoln, where the Lincoln Choral Artists will be having their annual fundraiser on March 3 at 4 p.m. Gentlemen, thank you for coming down to the Mill today, and best of luck with the event.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For more information on this event or anything else you hear about on Friday Live, go to netnebraska.org/radio and find the Friday Live page. I'm Robert Goldberg. Fashion Week in Omaha, Corbin Hirschhorn tells us more.
Winter is at its apex as far as the weather is concerned, but Omaha Fashion Week might spark the hope of spring around the corner. It's the nation's fifth largest fashion event going into its 11th year. Six nights of contemporary style, local talent, and parties at the Omaha Design Center, Monday through Saturday. It's a given that the outfits change with the season, but this festival's theme also reflects its community. Co-founder and producer of Omaha Fashion Week, Brooke Hudson.
There are differences, and those differences are specific to Omaha and our market and what we're doing. But the big thing for Omaha Fashion Week is in the spring, we have positioned the shows to be more about fashion for good. So you're going to see us leveraging this whole idea of fashion to raise funds for nonprofits, to recognize people who are cancer survivors on the runway. We have an entire night dedicated to cancer survivors, so we actually dress them and they have their hair and makeup done and they get to walk the runway and everybody, it's a night of standing ovations, basically. It's amazing.
In addition to working with the area's top fashion designers, models, and nonprofits, Omaha Fashion Week showcases students' creative work on the runway and behind the scenes.
The interesting thing about fashion and kids at like middle school and high school, and it's something that often doesn't get recognized about fashion, is that it is a way to engage students in topics that they wouldn't normally find interesting. So when you are creating a garment, you have to use math. You have to use some engineering skills. There is some science involved as you pick out what types of fabrics you're going to use and how you want them to perform on the body. So all of those subjects maybe a kid isn't interested in. Maybe you've got a girl who, for whatever reason, is not interested in science and math. Well, if you can get her involved in fashion design, suddenly it's opening up a whole new world to her and it's allowing her to use, a side of her brain that maybe she hadn't used before. And so that, I think, is really interesting and an awesome thing to get kids kind of engaged in that STEAM curriculum when they maybe don't even know it.
For the time leading up to the event and during, it's nonstop work for all hands on deck. Keeping models moving on the catwalk takes an organized brigade.
It's organized chaos. We have a group of hairstylists and makeup artists and also students who are studying to go into those professions that come together, and they formed this organization called the Omaha Beauty Alliance. And they are the ones backstage doing all the hair and makeup. And then we have a team of volunteers that help get the models to where they need to be when. Throughout the week, we have over 1,000 people that come through backstage for various purposes. So Buff Reynolds and Summer Kruger are kind of the two leads on the Beauty Alliance and managing backstage. And they, I don't know how they do it, but they somehow they have managed to create this super peaceful, relaxing atmosphere, even though there is so much work being done. I mean, at any given time, from 3 o'clock in the afternoon until probably 9 o'clock at night, we have about 18 models that are being styled at any given time during that time period.
Omaha Fashion Week is Monday through Saturday, February 25th to March 2nd at the Omaha Design Center starting at 6 p.m. Each night will open with the Pretty in Patina pre-party featuring live entertainment. For more information about schedule or tickets, visit omahafashionweek.com. For Friday Live, I'm Corbin Hershorn.
OmniArts Nebraska is in their seventh season. Beginning February 28th, they'll be presenting the musical Assassins. With us today are actors Ash Sharp, who plays the balladeer, Mary Douglas, a familiar voice on NET Radio, who acts as Sarah Jane Moore, and artistic director of OmniArts Nebraska, Daniel Kubert. The general premise of the musical is the portrayal of men and women who attempted to assassinate presidents of the United States. Daniel, tell us more about the play.
Well, the show is, it calls itself a reviewsical, which I don't really agree with. I think it's really well fleshed out. It is about the people who succeeded and did not succeed, some people not succeeding in very humorous ways. Mm-hmm. Mary Douglas. But it's, to me, our season is called Visions Manifest, and it's about the ways people manifest their visions, and sometimes the way that vision is thwarted and what manifests when one can't actually manifest their best vision of themselves. And so to me, that's really where I wanted to take the show. And that's really what the show is about. It's these people who have these deep-seated desires to be seen, to be heard, to have a location that are not afforded those opportunities. And then the extremes that they go to, either in retribution or to achieve these goals, however misguided they may be.
Mm. It's a rather macabre story, but it's a musical, so
it's
why?
It's very funny, though.
Yeah,
it's
why tell? Very funny. Why use music to tell the story?
I mean, I think that, I think music is one of the great muses of the spirit. I think that when you hear somebody singing beautifully, regardless of what they're singing about, it's going to touch your soul in a different way. Just the pure vibration of sound, I think, affects people in mysterious ways. And so I think that it's very appropriate that we would hear such a dark, twisted tale with the use of music, and certainly with the use of a balladeer who comes out and tells the story, and another character, the proprietor, who is sort of the counterpart and sort of the all that is bad versus all that is good, encapsulating it all. And, you know, music, Stephen Sondheim can write funny lyrics. The man knows how to rhyme. Like, he could rhyme anything with anything. So it helps the humor, and it helps move it along, and it helps keep it interesting. But it also draws people in a really visceral way,
right,
I think.
Right. Well, you mentioned the balladeer. So, Ash, you're the balladeer, who's also the narrator. How do you see that dual-like role? What is a balladeer versus a narrator?
From what I understand, I sing some ballads. I enter with a guitar, and I introduce a character, give a little quick description on what they're about, what they believe in, what they think their causes or their justice, you know, of why they're doing the act they're doing. And as Daniel was saying, some kind of like angelic creature, you know, where I'm overseeing everything and also having slight interaction with the assassins as well.
Slight interaction. Well, Mary, you play Sarah Jane Moore, who tried to assassinate Gerald Ford. There are not that many female assassins, although Gerald Ford, he had two attempts on his life by women. So how did you prepare for this role and get into her mind?
Well, I did a lot of research, actually, on Sarah Jane Moore, and I watched a very disturbing interview on CNN. I think it was the 40th year anniversary of her trying to assassinate him, and she sounds like much the same as she did when she attempted to assassinate him. So she's really fascinating. Like,
has she had a change of heart, or she's still?
Nope. She totally. She described herself as a really good citizen then and now. So it made it that much more interesting. I'm like, well, I love someone who's convicted, even though those convictions are absolutely incorrect.
Yes, and being a good citizen yourself, you can absolutely get into the role, I'm sure.
Yes.
Daniel, the musical covers several different eras, and what challenge did that pose in terms of costume, set design, and from a production point of view?
Well, it's pretty easy, actually, because so much of it spans so many different years and so many different eras. And the way that it's written, it exists in sort of this limbo where all of the assassins actually sit at a bar together and communicate with one another and have relationships back and forth. And so really the way that I wanted to do it is I took the ensemble and I want them to be in gray silhouettes, and they are the viewers, they are the observers, they are us. Mm-hmm. And then the assassins all will be dressed according to the period in which they assassinated, you know, or attempted to assassinate the president. And so I didn't really view it as like as a challenge necessarily, but as an opportunity to create this really complicated and beautiful tapestry of space and time and location, and really an enjoyable challenge, certainly.
Yeah. Well, gain insight into the intrigues of presidential assassinations at Omni Arts' presentation of Assassins. The show opens tomorrow night and continues through March 3rd in the Johnny Carson Theater at the Lead Center. Daniel, Ash, and Mary, thank you for being here this morning, and best of luck with the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Albright is a young pianist with some impressive accomplishments under his belt and with the promise to become one of the great pianists of his generation. He's performed across the country and the world, and we're lucky to have him make a Nebraska stop in Kearney on March 4th. Charlie, it's such a privilege to speak to you. Thank you for taking time to chat this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Charlie, your story is somewhat unorthodox. An economics major as an undergrad, albeit combined with music, and your extraordinary awards not so much from competitions as from distinguished prizes such as the Avery Fisher Career Grant and as a Gilmore Young Artist. How has the way your career has unfolded influenced the pianist that you are and hope to become?
I've been very blessed to be able to do what I love to do. And when I started piano, it was kind of untraditional in a way. I started when I was very young. I was about 3 and a half when I climbed up on a piano bench, and I guess I started picking out kind of Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. And I only played by ear for several years. So I couldn't read a note of music until I started with my first kind of main teacher, Nancy Adsit, and who kind of introduced me to classical music and she forced me to learn how to read music and all that stuff. I've kind of taken a different approach to, you know, growing up with music than a lot of people who start and, you know, learn how to read from the get-go. I've been just been very blessed to be able to do what I love and, you know, to receive, you know, some of these awards along the way.
How old were you when you had that first piano lesson?
I started when I was about 3 and a half. I took from several little local teachers who kind of taught me by ear. You know, one of them was one very influential person was a lady who owned a piano and organ store in my small town who taught me by ear and taught me everything from In the Mood to Great Balls of Fire. And when I started classical music, trying to read with Nancy Adsit, it was about 7 or 8 years old that I was.
Well, I've listened to several of your performances, and I'm struck by similarities I hear between you and two other pianists specifically, Georgi Tsifra and Cyprian Katsaris, in your liquid technique, the way you voice lines, and of course in your gift for improvisation. Have they been an influence? And talk about some other pianists, past and present, who you see as masters.
I don't listen to a lot of classical music myself. A lot of times people assume that I just listen to classical music all the time. And, you know, for me in the car, it's Korean pop and you know, regular pop music, pretty much anything, and mostly non-related to classical. as far as pianists go, I love Richard Good, Marie Pariah, Emmanuel Ax, Russell Sherman, to name a few. I admire, you know, Yo-Yo Ma and Joshua Bell and, you know, other artists who, through other instruments, really bring out the joy in the music.
Why do you think public improvisation is so rare these days? Why is it important to you? And share your thoughts about what place you think improvisation should have on the modern concert stage.
Number one, it's a blast to do. I love doing it. It's just a whole lot of fun. You never know what you're going to get. And oftentimes what I do is I'll have audience members give random notes. I'll get three or four notes from the audience and then use that as the basis for a 5 or 10 or even 30-minute long piece of music where you flesh that out. It used to be done all the time, improvisation, and today it's really almost never done anymore. And I think it's a shame because I think of, you know, composing and improvising as kind of the other side of the coin that is music. You know, on one side you have playing pieces that were written down by other people and putting your own interpretational stamp on it, right? And on the other side you have, you know, creating something of your own. You have even more flexibility in that way because not only are you kind of interpreting what you're doing, but you're interpreting yourself, that is, but you also can really make it go any which way that you want. Improvisation kind of takes that to an extreme because, kind of like impromptu speaking, you don't necessarily have the chance to go back and edit. If you do something wrong when you're in front of 2,000 people doing an improvisation, you can't necessarily come back and decide that you're going to, oh, never mind, I'm going to erase that and edit it and do this a little bit differently. You have to go with whatever comes out. And so it's really kind of music at its most pure form and in its most raw form. So it's great.
Do you compose?
Mainly through improvisation, though. So I have someone who works with me to write down a lot of the stuff because I just don't have the time to sit down and write it out note for note. So I'll send recordings and stuff and then have the person transcribe it down all for me.
Well, you're passing through Nebraska next week. Tell us what's on the program for your concert in Kearney.
So what's really fun about the concert I'm doing in Kearney is it's part of a big marathon concert tour I'm giving all throughout the Midwest. I'm giving about a concert a day over the course of a month and driving about 4 hours a day to boot. And this whole tour is great because it's really kind of flexible as to what I can play. So at each of these concerts, I'm announcing what I'm playing from the stage before each piece. And sometimes it changes and sometimes it doesn't. But it's going to be a big combination of all kinds of music, from contemporary classical music by maybe Giancarlo Menotti to a Schultzevler romantic transcription of the Blue Danube Waltz to maybe Great Balls of Fire. You know, just a little bit of everything and keeping it really kind of fun.
It sounds like an interesting recital. So what goes into putting a program together? Is it always this free form or do you sometimes plan a recital and sort of that's the program for the season?
This Midwest tour, it's really fun because it's completely free and open. So, you know, one day I could play a completely different program than I play maybe in another town the next day if I feel like it. Other times, depending on the series, sometimes concert organizers will prefer to have a little bit more of a firmer, solid program because they need to choreograph it with maybe other people who are going to be coming and playing on the same series. They don't want people playing too much of the same thing in any one year, for example.
Well, I've been chatting with Charlie Albright, who's giving a recital in Kearney on Monday, March the 4th. Charlie, thank you so much for talking with me by phone this morning.
Thank you very much.
For more on this recital or anything else you hear about on Friday Live, go to netnebraska.org/radio and look for the Friday Live page. I'm Robert Goldberg. You can hear an extended version of my conversation with Charlie Albright on this week's Friday Live Extra podcast. Download it wherever you get your podcasts or listen on the NET website at netnebraska.org/radio. The UNL student-run theater organization Theatrics presents Speech and Debate, written by Stephen Karam, starting next Thursday. The director of the production and the company's artistic director, Ethan Greenlee, and the lead actress, Emma Perizak, are both here this morning to tell us about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ethan, the play is called Speech and Debate, an ambiguous title that could mean a number of things. Tell us about the play.
Right. I'll be honest, it's very misleading. while the play does, It's about three kids who were trying to expose their high school drama teacher for having an inappropriate relationship with a student. And simultaneously, through their relationship, they are also setting up their school's first ever speech and debate team.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like an operatic intrigue. This is not a musical, but a dark comedy with music, which is a bit of a distinction. Is that a matter of semantics or more than that?
Could you explain?
Good question. Could I explain? Well, so there's music. There's music in the play, right? But it's not. Would you call it a musical?
No.
Right. So what would you say the role of music is, I guess, there in the play?
Well, it definitely serves to see our character's emotional life a little bit more, because the music that's in the play, it's really never together. They are all in their own private separate spaces, and they are all singing the same song, mm-hmm. Showing their different emotional lives about the same situation. So it's really just to give a second look at our characters and just kind of take a step back and just show them existing and living as they are.
Great. Well, Emma, you take the lead in this production. Tell us about your character.
Oh, Dawada Jones. She is...
That's a name.
That is quite a name, yeah. She is super passionate about the theater, and I feel like I connect with that super well because acting. And she wants to be an actress after high school, but she has a conflict with her drama teacher, Mr. Healy, who... She's very untalented, actually, and she's super frumpy and odd, but she wears her heart on her sleeve, and she will go for whatever she wants at the moment and do whatever she can to get what she wants and just live the life that she wants to live.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, you stole a bit of my next question, which was, how do you relate to the character?
Well, I think a lot of performers can relate to Dawada in general because she wants to be heard and she wants to be a star and she wants to be seen and just understood. And I think that is probably the root of what a lot of performers feel, yeah. I think.
Right.
That's how I feel.
Theatrix is entirely run by students. Could you both speak a bit about the company?
Yes, absolutely. So yes, Theatrix is completely student-run, from the graphic designer to all of the designers of the production, to the actors, to the management team. So it's essentially just kind of a practice for theater students to get the feel of what it takes to run a theater company, mm-hmm. and the different roles that one needs to take in a theater company. And it's such a fabulous experience for us in learning how to be professional and learning how to treat others with respect in the workplace environment in a way that's different from normal theater classes and productions. And
right. Well,
like
it's
that.
Important. You know, there's so much more to theater. It's about these personal relationships and everything else, right. More than just what happens on the stage. Mm-hmm. Well, Ethan, what's next for Theatrix? Any upcoming productions?
After this, we have This Is War, directed by Krista Retka, which is a play about characters in the Canadian Army. And
Canada has an army?
Yes, they do. and the mistreatment of women in the army setting.
Okay, interesting. Well, UNL student-run theater organization Theatrix presents Speech and Debate February 28th and March 1st and 2nd at 7:30 p.m. and March 3rd at 2 p.m. at the Lab Theater on the third floor of the Temple Building on the UNL City Campus. Ethan Greenlee, the director of the production and also the company's artistic director, and lead actress Emma Perizak were both here to tell us about it. Thank you both again, Emma and Stephen.
Thank you.
For more information about this production or anything you hear on Friday Live, go to netnebraska.org/radio and look for the Friday Live page. And you won't want to miss next week's show. There'll be live music performed by a variety of musicians right here at the Mill. You'll also be able to stream video of the next show via Facebook Live. Head to the Friday Live page to learn more at netnebraska.org/radio. I'm Robert Goldberg.
Coming up this morning on NET Radio, classical music on Morning Concert, and this afternoon, Classics by Request with Bruce Wallace. Be sure to visit the NET website for podcasts of the show at netnebraska.org/radio. Thanks to everyone who makes Friday Live possible, including Elise Stasny, Genevieve Randall, engineer James Duchesneau, and associate producer Dave Hughes. I'm Robert Goldberg.
Support for programming on NET Radio comes from the Lead Center for Performing Arts in Lincoln, presenting the San Francisco Symphony March 28th. They return to the lead, led by conductor Michael Tilson Thomas, performing the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto in E minor and the Sibelius Symphony No. 2 in D major. For ticket information, leadcenter.org. And Aubin Music, presenting the Classical Vocal Quartet, New York Polyphony. Sunday, February 24th at 4 p.m., First Plymouth Church in Lincoln. For tickets, aubinmusic.org.